Welcome back for the third hour of Issues Etc. In about 25 minutes, Randy Thomason, Executive Director of Campaign for California Families, joins us. He'll join us from Sacramento to talk about what's going on yesterday and today in the California Supreme Court. Yesterday, there were arguments made in favor of and against the mayor there in San Francisco who had issued marriage licenses to almost 4,000 gay couples. It's not about the validity of the licenses themselves. That's a separate issue. This has to do whether or not the mayor broke the law, and if so, what will be done with the mayor of San Francisco on that issue. We'll be talking with Randy Thomason about that in about 25 minutes. In the meantime, Suzanne Venker joins us for part three in our seven-part daily series on working mothers. Suzanne is a former middle school teacher. She is the author of the new book, Seven Myths of Working Mothers, and she joins us from here in St. Louis. Suzanne, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Hi, Todd.
The myth we're going to try and dispel today is most commonly put in the phrase, you're so lucky you can stay home, implying that, you know, not everyone can stay home, but if you can, boy, are you lucky. Let's set the context for this by talking about some research that has been recently done that I know you're well aware of. The two-income trap. Tell us about it.
Yeah, that was a book. I think it was authored by a woman named Elizabeth Warren and her daughter. And the basic message in that book, although in retrospect I'm not sure it's exactly the reason that they wrote it, I don't know, but at any rate, what you get from that book is that families actually fare better economically when a parent is home. And a lot of people don't quite understand this, and the point of the message is that many people don't understand the economics involved in raising children. That is to say, if you are a dual-income family and you do not have any children, clearly you're in a win-win situation. But the moment you throw kids into the equation, you're no longer in a win-win situation, and the reason for that is because it actually, surprise, costs money to raise children. And if you do not do that work yourself, then clearly you have to pay someone to do it for you. And not only are you paying them also, not only are you paying them just to raise your children, you're also going to have to, or often you do anyway, pay people to help you with your household chores, and you spend money on convenience foods and all those sorts of things that go along with having a dual income life. And it just doesn't come out in the wash financially. Now, the average dual income family today, this is the most recent statistics from the Census Bureau, make $73,000 a year. The average one-income family makes $49,000. That's a difference of $24,000. And once you do the math on this and you subtract your work-related costs, your child care, of course, which is your biggest, and the taxes, and all of the commuting I don't know if I said convenience foods, did I? But all of the things that go along with that lifestyle, you net maybe $6,000 or $7,000 a year. That's the average family today.
So in other words, just in terms of dollars and cents, mm-hmm. it is cheaper sometimes and more economical for the mother to stay home with the kids rather than trying to add that second income and have the mother outside the house paying for other people to do what she would normally be doing as the mother.
That's correct. And there's actually another book that we didn't mention called The Price of Motherhood that was written by Ann Crittenden, and it came out several years ago. And that book talks, the whole purpose of that book is to talk about what it would actually cost us as society if we hypothetically were to pay mothers for the services they perform. Okay? So that includes, again, of course, the child care and the household and those things that are, you know, they're seemingly elusive and that seem, again, very mundane. But if you don't do them, someone else has to do them. So hypothetically, if you were to pay a mother, I can't remember, she came up with some figure after 18 years at home of like $1 million or something. But the point is simply that, yes, there's actual costs incurred in raising children. So you are better off to do it yourself.
Another thing I wanted to talk about in terms of the income, and you had pointed this out in previous conversations on this subject, Suzanne, and that is that those who utilize daycare the most are are not people of lower incomes, but generally speaking, people of higher incomes. Explain that.
That's correct, and I call that the class nature of daycare. And that is that the families who are most likely to use daycare are those earning over $75,000 family income. And the income bracket that has the highest number of at-home moms are those earning $20,000 to $25,000 a year.
Now, how do we, the stereotypical picture mm-hmm. that we get in the popular press is that we have to have this, women have to work because it's going to be the people who are struggling just to get by who need to do this and put their kids in daycare. It doesn't sound like $75,000 a year, they're struggling to get by.
No, it's a lie. Hence the name Seven Myths of Working Mothers. Because you see, the people who are putting forth this this myth are hardline feminists who are calling for a very different system, and they want want government to do the work for us. So in order to kind of get people on their side, so to speak, they must twist things to make it seem as though this is just a given. I mean, I remember Peggy Orenstein, who just only recently had her first child, finally, after for years talking about daycare and what children need, is made the comment that it takes two incomes for basic survival. And I thought that was so astounding that I used that quote in the chapter to then piggyback onto this whole idea of what basic survival is and how people in my generation, and obviously I'm including myself, have no idea what basic survival is. So it's almost embarrassing to people who, for example, during the Depression, know what it means to make ends meet and stretch a dime into a dollar. It's insulting to talk about today's lifestyle or today's generation having any clue what that means to survive.
I remember the first time we talked on the air, Suzanne, very shortly afterward, I got a response from a listener, generally, you know, enjoys the program, but they said, you made it sound as, not you, but both of us, made it sound as though women should never stay home, and I mean, women should never go into the workplace. Don't you understand that some women do have to work? Are you saying that women never have to work?
Oh my gosh, no. Ever? Their whole lives? No. If you read the book, it's very clear that the message is not that you are never to be in the workforce. The message is, yes, go get an education. Yes, go out into the workforce. Postpone motherhood if that's what you want to do. Why not? But understand that once you have children, there's a job to be done there. And in the scheme of things, if you look at your life, and as I say, this 40-year plan, you know, spending some years at home really is not all that big of a deal. I also comment on the fact that there are ways to work part-time, and there are ways to work around your children's needs and schedules depending on how many children you have and how old they are. So, no, you can go in and out of the workforce. There's actually a term for that. It's called sequencing. And there was an actual book written with that same title in 1986. And that's what I'm doing, and that's what I suggest that people do if they want to work outside the home. But it has to be around your children's needs, and that's the key. So, no, of course there's going to be people and women in the workforce. You know, I had a in the Webster Kirkwood Times, there had been some editorials that had been going back and forth about my book based on an article that was written about the book, and one of the responses, well, it got several responses, and the man compared me to, you know, asking women to live like they do in Saudi Arabia. what you just said from the caller made me think of that I was suggesting that women must stay in the home their whole lives and never emerge from them. Of course, it's ridiculous.
Unless you have a burqa on, of course.
A what?
Unless
exactly.
You have a burqa. I was about a year ago on one of our regular visits down to my hometown to see my folks and my family. And a little stroll down nostalgia lane for the sake of the kids before all these things got bulldozed when they're putting up Costco's and mm-hmm. Walmart's. My dad took us around and showed. I said, I want to see all the places you lived when you first moved down here. Can you show me the first house you had? Because these are things that we used to drive by when I was a kid, and I remember seeing these little places back in 1958 when they moved to Dallas, and he's a newly minted engineer, you know, starting, you know, in electrical engineering. Well, we drove past these places, and the ones that we could find little cracker boxes of houses, very tiny. One, I said, what was in this place? Oh, that was, you know, one bedroom, the kitchen, and then something that we called the living room, which was more of an area. And that was our first house. And that's and they were glad to have it in 1958 as their first home. That's what they expected to live in right out of college.
That's not the way it is today, is
Nowadays,
it?
You got to have three bedrooms, two full bathrooms. Mm-hmm. You got to have at least a double car garage because you're going to have two cars as well.
Mm-hmm.
The expectations seem, well, at least for the young couple, newly married without kids, unrealistically high.
They are, and I do talk about that in the book. Exactly, the difference between today and yesterday, really. There's a quote that I open with in this chapter that says, from Mary Eberstadt, who's a social scientist, and she says, many women must work because of material needs, but such needs do not begin to account for our contemporary rate of maternal absence. And that really sums up kind of a response to what you said. You had a caller the other day who asked me about this. And that's kind of it in a nutshell. It's not that there's a denial that there are some families or some women or mothers, excuse me, who need to be in the workforce. The question is not whether or not that's true, because everybody's financial circumstances are different, and people fall on hard times for all kinds of reasons. The question is, how far has that reality been stretched to accommodate, you know, skewing away from what a real need is to a want? And that's the focus of Chapter 3.
You also quote from the book The Millionaire Next Door, obviously a very popular book there, about what's the difference between income and wealth?
Yeah, exactly. I think they say in there that wealth is not the same as income. If you spend what you make, you're not getting wealthier, you're just living high. And nowhere is that more accurate or true about today's lifestyle or today's generation. This is exactly why we have an average household credit card debt of $8,000. This just didn't happen 50 years ago. If you didn't have the money, you just simply didn't get it, period. So we're in up to our necks in debt in this country. And that's exactly the reason why, because we are handed credit cards the moment we're 18, even younger today. And we do live on this, you know, buy now, pay later world. And that has caused us to need and want things now, not wait until Christmas to get it. And there's no way we can go back in the sense that, you know, my mother and I have this discussion all the time. She's probably listening to me and laughing right now because she definitely knows what it's like to grow up that way, whereas I don't. I mean, I never had to wait until Christmas time just to get the simplest of whatever, and she did. So she was always very conscious of that, and that's and the reason I'm even the way that I am today is because she instilled her own upbringing into me, even though I didn't have to, quote-unquote, suffer the way that she did, although she wouldn't call it suffering at all. But, there's no end to the way we're living today and how it's affecting the issue of working motherhood.
You're listening to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkins. Suzanne Venker is our guest. She's author of the new book, Seven Myths of Working Mothers. If you have a question or a comment on this subject, give us a call here in the next 10 minutes, 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. So it sounds as though this is not only a question of one's life philosophy, to put it in general terms, but also of basic economics.
Yeah, it is. And if I could I just read just something here from my book?
Please
do. I have to look at it because it's a little bit too long. But Robert Reich wrote a book called The Future of Success. He was the former, I can't remember what now, President Clinton.
Yeah.
And he quit his job because it was all-consuming. And he took a lot of flack for that because he said that he came home one night too late and his son said something to him that was just so moving, and it made him realize that he's never around and he just has to stop the madness. So he quit his job. He says in this book, The Future of Success, Reich explains that by becoming wealthier, one would assume we could afford ourselves more time for the more important aspects of our lives, such as our family, friends, and ourselves. This is me writing, I'm paraphrasing what he said in his book. But in fact, the opposite has occurred. The wealthier we become, the less time we devote to our lives outside of work, the less time we spend with our families. He writes that the question we should be asking ourselves is, quote, would we choose this new reality if we fully appreciated its consequences for the family life we might otherwise have? In other words, is this new economy worth what it costs us? And that is kind of the gist of the chapter in getting us to think about what we're saying and what we mean when we say we must work, we have to work. What do we really mean by that?
Beverly is calling from her car, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Beverly, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Hi, Todd. Hi, I enjoy your guest so much. I just want to make the comment that I am working. My children are a little bit older, but I do encourage young mothers that I work with that are struggling about not wanting to go back to work when the baby's born, and I try to encourage them to find a way to stay home. And I'm not kidding. The most comment I hear, well, my husband just bought a brand new truck. Well, have him sell the truck. Well, he doesn't want to. That is very prevalent in the younger generation also, unwilling to make the other spouse see what really needs to be done.
Beverly, thank you very much. I've heard this before, that a lot of times the women are working so that their husbands can have his toys.
I'm glad Beverly brought that up. I touch upon this at the end of the book, not specifically the way she described, although she's right. That's exactly what's happening, and I can think of some people I know who would fall under that category. The way I take a step back and say, how did we get here? How do we get to a place where we now have men saying the opposite of, ain't no way my wife is going to work, from the 50s, to, yeah, you better be working. How did we get this far? And at the end of the book, I suggest that the women's movement in this sense backfired, because ultimately what we were trying to do, supposedly, or one of the things we were trying to do, is to get men and fathers to appreciate and understand the work that went into raising children, because there was so much of a disconnect there, because the men were gone, the women were at home, and they didn't understand one another. So what we ended up doing, instead of getting them to appreciate it and getting them more involved, although we have gotten them more involved, but rather than making that be the focus, we then join men in their world, and we now have both people out of the house, and now men have even lesser regard for motherhood than they did before, because nobody gets it, because nobody's home to do it, to see what's involved. That mixed with the economy piece that we've been talking about has caused not just mothers, but fathers to want their wives in the workforce. And how sad that is, it's unbelievable.
I'm thinking about George W. Bush's former press secretary, and then she was a longtime advisor when he was governor of Texas, who early in the Bush administration left Washington, went back to, I guess it was Texas.
Karen Hughes.
And then, of course, wrote a book about this, and people continuously ask her, why did you leave Washington? Why did you leave the administration? And she kept on saying, my family. And no, it's got to be more complicated than that. No, it's just that simple. I wanted to be with my kids.
I know. It is astounding that people, they really don't get it. That's how pathetic that everything is right now. Hence the reason for the book. Can we wake up a little bit here? What is going on? And that's actually a funny thing that you brought her up, because the CNN thing that I told you about the other day,
sure,
the producer had called me the night before. You know, she was pretending to interview me. And or pre-telephone interview is what they call it. And they try to gather some information for the next night's interview. And during that telephone conversation, she said, so in other words, you would support what Karen Hughes did recently. And I said, and the first thing that came to my mind was, well, wouldn't anybody? I mean, who wouldn't? And she laughed, kind of a nervous laugh, you know, like, what a logical thing to think. Why would there be any question there? You know, I was really, I knew that people had responded that way, but I was kind of trying to make a point that I can't believe there's actual conflict there, that people don't understand it. So I thought that was interesting. She was wondering. She was clearly wondering whether or not I thought that was okay or good.
Annie is calling from South St. Louis. Annie, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Hi.
Hi.
I'm really enjoying this conversation, and I just wanted to call in, and I'm a full-time stay-at-home mom. I used to work full-time. And just in the past 6 months, I've been babysitting my niece. And until then, I didn't realize how that whoever is watching your children, whether it be you, whoever, that's the person who is raising your child. during the day. Even though, you know, my husband comes home at night and, you know, of course he's helping me, but I am the primary influence, model, et cetera. And so I don't think a lot of women who work realize that.
Annie, thank you so much. Suzanne.
Yeah, well, she's absolutely right. And, of course, I state that point blank, exactly what she just said in the book. And I say it because I don't think people, I think people think it. You know, all the Annies of the world who are home doing this work see it every day. Just like teachers see so many things every day when they're with children, they can't necessarily say it to the parents. We see it, but you don't want to say it in that way. Well, but the reality is, you know it, and I did write it in the book because until we are able to face the elephant in the room, so to speak, we can't move forward with this issue because that's exactly what's happening. Strangers are raising our children. They're not babysitting. They're not watching them. They're raising them. If you're talking about on a full-time basis, they're raising them.
Bringing together the two aspects we've discussed here in a final question, Suzanne, about the philosophy here of life and then also the economics, the basic dollars and cents issues. You have written this, and this is the quote that always jumps out to me in this chapter. It is time that we stop making money the scapegoat. Raising children is a choice, not a luxury. What do you mean?
Yeah, what I mean is that life is about hard choices, and everything we do, ultimately, whether we want to admit it or not during the time in which we're making them, is a choice. And every day you're faced with different paths you can take. And whatever path we take, there are going to be consequences. And 9 out of 10 times, unless, of course, we're hit, and there's always going to be disasters and unforeseen circumstances, and I'm not trying to deny those at all. They exist. But as far as generalizing, we are in control of our lives and our destiny and how they come out in the end. And we have a choice to make a detour if we think we've made a bad one. But in the end, it really is about that. It's not about events before us that keep us from being able to have free will and freedom and choice. It's a matter of what we want.
Suzanne Venker, thank you very much for being our guest.
Thanks, Todd.
Folks, you can find out more about Suzanne Venker's new book, Seven Myths of Working Mothers, at www.spencepublishing.com, www.spencepublishing.com, or you can call Spence Publishing toll-free, 1-888-SPENPUB, 1-888-SPENPUB. The book is called Seven Myths of Working Mothers. It's currently being offered at half price. I'm thinking about all the ladies out there who haven't written books like Karen Hughes has, and they find themselves defending their decision to stay home with their kids. They find themselves saying, you know, how do, when someone says to you, you're wasting your education, or someone says, oh, you're lucky, you get to stay home, you can stay home. How do you answer those things? This book is a great defense for the mother who stays home with her children. Seven Myths of Working Mothers, 1-888-SPEN-HUB. When we come back from this break, we're going to be rounding off these 3 hours of Issues, Etc. in the last 25 minutes with Randy Thomason, Executive Director of Campaign for California Families. You've read the headlines about the California Supreme Court and the mayor of San Francisco and those 4,000 marriage licenses. We'll talk about it when we come back.
Talk radio for the thinking Christian. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
What is Lutheran theology really all about? Is it about the Lutheran Reformation? Is it about not being a Roman Catholic? Is it about Martin Luther? No, Lutheran theology is really all about Jesus. Learn more in our Issues, Etc. Book of the Month for May, Why I Am a Lutheran, Jesus at the Center by Pastor Daniel Preuss. You can order Why I Am a Lutheran, Jesus at the Center by calling Concordia Publishing House any weekday during regular business hours. Their number, 1-800-325-3040, 1-800-325-3040. Or learn more about our Issues, Etc. Book of the Month for May, Why I Am a Lutheran, by visiting our Issues, Etc. website, issuesetc.org. Under the What's New section, you'll find out more about our Issues, Etc. Book of the Month for May, Why I Am a Lutheran, Jesus at the Center.
Gay marriage, Now, what's wrong with it?
Answers with Ken Ham, president of the Bible-defending ministry of Answers in Genesis. Well, Ken, if someone asked you what was wrong with gay marriage, how would you answer that question? From the Bible?
I was watching CNN's Larry King interview a very famous Christian leader about the homosexual issue. At one point in their conversation, Larry King asked this leader something like this: why do you ultimately believe it's wrong to be gay? And what's the reason for your stand? This leader then answered by saying that down through the ages, culture after culture has viewed marriage as primarily between a man and a woman. I was shocked, even saddened, by this answer. The Christian leader was speaking out against homosexual behavior, and yet his answer in reality gave a basis for accepting it. You see, by appealing to cultural reason, he was in effect saying that it was a matter of opinion. So this undermined his whole argument. This Christian leader should have said something like this: Larry, regardless of what you and others think about it, the Bible claims to be the revealed word of God. I believe that to be true, and I can give you lots of confirmations from science and other areas that it is what it claims. The Bible's my absolute authority, and God's word clearly states that homosexual behavior is a sin. That's why I'm against it.
In 25 years of ministry, perhaps the most asked question Ken has received is, where did Cain find his wife? For the answer, read his free booklet at AnswersRadio.com. AnswersRadio.com.
This is Dr. John Tape with the Media Minute. Violence in the media can cause children to be violent in real life. A joint statement signed by the American Medical Association and five other professional organizations says, quote, "The conclusion of the public health community, based on over 30 years of research, is that viewing entertainment violence can lead to increases in aggressive behavior," end quote. Don't allow your children to watch violent TV shows or play violent video games. Remind your children that Jesus died on the cross so that His peace would fill our lives. With Jesus in our lives, there's no room for hatred, revenge, angry words, or violence of any kind, be it real or on the screen. This Media Minute is brought to you by the Christian Media Literacy Institute. Please visit our website at cmli.org.
We have a lot of symbolism to deal with next time on the Bible study as we continue in Ezekiel chapters 4 and 5. We have a clay tablet, we have an iron pan, we have a sharp sword like a barber's razor. What's it all mean? We'll ask Professor Bob Weiss next time on The Bible Study for Ezekiel 4 and 5. The Bible Study, weekday morning, 10:05.
The Bible Study on AM 850 KFUO is underwritten by Concordia Christian Books and Gifts, serving God's people.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. 25 minutes left in the program. Tomorrow on the program, we'll continue our series with Suzanne Venker, Seven Myths of Working Mothers. We're going to be on the fourth myth. I could balance work and family if I had more support. I call that It Takes a Village myth. We'll get her response to that tomorrow on Issues Etc. In addition to that, we'll be talking with Bill Salmon, Washington Times senior White House correspondent, who has written a new book called Misunderestimated: The President Battles Terrorism, John Kerry, and the Bush Haters. We'll be talking with the author of that book tomorrow on Issues Etc. Randy Thomason is our guest. For the last 25 minutes of the program, we're going to be talking to him about what's going on in the California Supreme Court. Yesterday, arguments were made in favor and against the actions of San Francisco Mayor Newsom, who had issued almost 4,000 marriage licenses to gay couples before the Supreme Court put the kibosh on it. At question in the Supreme Court's current deliberations is not so much the validity of those licenses, but whether or not the San Francisco mayor acted within the bounds of his office or outside the bounds of the law. We're going to be talking about what's been happening there in San Francisco. Randy Thomason is our guest. He joins us from Sacramento. Randy, welcome back.
Hey, Todd. Great to be with you. Thank you for covering what is not just about California, but is for everyone, because when bad politicians take the law in their own hands and judges make law instead of just following the law, our entire system of government and our entire country is threatened.
Randy, as Executive Director of Campaign for California Families, you have been watching this very closely, I know, and also since it's a California issue, as you rightly point out, not only a California issue. What did Mayor Newsom do there in San Francisco, and what is the Supreme Court trying to figure out in the course of this deliberation?
Well, Gavin Newsom, as most people who watch TV this year know, he started issuing homosexual marriage licenses, and he took the law into his own hands. Instead of following state law, he declared state law unconstitutional. He basically shirked his duties as a county agent of the state, and he altered government documents. And so he did many things wrong in the course of that, violating over 8 state laws. And no one has even looked into the conspiracy angle of this, but I believe it was conspiracy to commit crimes. He basically shirked the law, and this was hauled into court finally. And a temporary injunction of early March is now going through the process, and they're asking should a permanent injunction be ordered. That was the discussion in court yesterday. There were minor discussions on top of that. Should the 4,037 homosexual marriage licenses be declared invalid, be declared null and void, or are they just already null and void, or should they hang around for the future? There were some bad judges who were saying, hey, they are looking forward to a Massachusetts homosexual marriage type case that would come to them in about 2 years, and they might want to graft these 4,000 gay marriage licenses into that. That was the most shocking thing I heard, as some justices on the panel actually inviting a Massachusetts-style homosexual marriage case.
Now, what's the defense being put forth by Gavin Newsom and his attorneys to justify essentially acting not only outside the bounds of his office — he simply had no authority to do what he was doing — but also acting outside the bounds of, as you point out, several California laws?
They said, hey, San Francisco's attorneys are saying a local government official can reject any law that he thinks is unconstitutional.
If this is true, what becomes of the general law in a state like California?
Well, it's a recipe for anarchy and chaos, obviously. The judges on the court, the high court, were questioning that. You mean that's all that's needed? Good faith, they called it, which was an interesting choice of words. A local official just has to have good faith that he or she believes a law is unconstitutional, so he or she doesn't enforce it. And the lesbian attorney for the city, Therese Stewart, who was there, she said, there are some limits, but she didn't define limits. And so really it was a recipe for anarchy. And the judges brought up several examples where, hey, if we allow this to go forward, we could see any local official making any conservative or liberal law they want to, and that's an even greater mess.
I mean, then we've talked so much about judicial activism here. We're now in the realm of mayoral activism. If I'm a county clerk, it can become clerkish activism. I don't know how you'd put that in the right terms.
Right. I mean, really, if we put this in the context of history, if we started seeing judicial activism at the United States Supreme Court in the late 40s, you know, and then the 50s when they started throwing the Bible and prayer out of schools, and then the early 70s when they made up the right to abortion, etc. Now we're seeing a new breed of tyranny, of barbarian activism, I call it. It's called no order, no Republican principles, no constitutional principles. We are now seeing elected officials break the law. And so, obviously, there has to be consequences to that. I think there should be punishment. But Gavin Newsom is going to get off lightly. He'll just see his little invention be called invalid. But it's sad that it was allowed to go on so long. My prediction, Todd, is we're going to see a permanent injunction stopping San Francisco and every other municipality in California from breaking the marriage laws. But we're also going to see more of a push for a Massachusetts-style homosexual marriage case to be going step by step through the California courts. And it's made me think about, hey, some of these judges can be recalled. And I was glad to be in court yesterday to find out how bad things were because we've got more work to do.
I'm wondering, Gavin Newsom is an elected official, and I'm sure that there is some mechanism by which he can be deposed from office.
Well, there is. But this is San Francisco. And San Francisco is the most liberal city on the West Coast. It is a law unto itself. You don't want to be killed in San Francisco because they don't have a death penalty that's enforced. There's a cop who was gunned down, and the local county district attorney said, well, we're not going to seek the death penalty. You have marijuana being distributed in the city without it being clamped down. You've got homosexual bathhouses spreading disease. Nothing going. No clamping down on that. There is corruption in the San Francisco city government, and it just shows that the corrupt values that are promoting homosexuality, transsexuality, abortion, homosexual marriage that are coming out of the city are also corrupt. On the city attorney's website, the city attorney, Dennis Herrera, actually has he's really touting the thing he's most proud of, San Francisco versus Ashcroft, all over partial birth abortion. The city attorney of San Francisco is so proud to support partial birth abortion, that's the top story on his website.
Proposition 22 passed very handily in California some years back. What role does this law play in the whole issue of Gavin Newsom and whether or not he could do what he was doing, and the possible validity or invalidity of the 4,000 marriage licenses that were issued?
Well, Proposition 22, the vote of the people to protect marriage, is one of about eight laws on the state books that protects marriage for a man and a woman. And those laws themselves show that San Francisco was wrong. But the vote of the people is a process that the courts have more respect for. When the people vote for something, that carries more weight in the eyes of the justices here than a law that the legislature puts on the books. So we have a good foundation in the law to repel the homosexual marriage attack. The only problem is if judges get the same idea as Gavin Newsom and say, hey, you know what, the statutes say marriage is for a man and a woman, but let's go higher than that. Let's go to the Constitution and let's take this phrase, equal protection, and turn it into homosexual marriage like Massachusetts did. And I'd like to take just a moment to educate us all what equal protection means. The 14th Amendment of the United States, which was passed after the Civil War, was basically saying that former black slaves shall have the rights of free men. And the actual quote is, no state shall make or enforce any law which shall abridge the privileges or immunities of citizens of the United States, nor shall any state deprive any person of life, liberty, or property without due process of law, nor deny to any person within its jurisdiction the equal protection of the laws. Sounds pretty open and shut. No lynchings, no thrown in jail without a trial. And when we talk about equal protection of the laws, we are lifting up the value of the law. The law is to be applied fairly, and the law on marriage says you can get married to anyone you want who wants to marry you, as long as you're both of age, not closely related, and of the opposite sex. That is the law that is fairly applied on marriage nationwide. And there is absolutely nothing in the 14th Amendment that says there's a right to homosexual marriage. It's talking about any person cannot be denied a right, but it doesn't say any couple can't be denied a right. So there's no right to coupleship in here.
Randy Thomason is our guest, Executive Director of Campaign for California Families, joining us from Sacramento to talk about the Supreme Court arguments and the case that's being made regarding Gavin Newsom, the San Francisco mayor, and his issuance of marriage licenses to 4,000 gay couples. Randy, can you? We talked a bit about this before, but what other arguments were made both for and against the actions of the mayor there in the Supreme Court yesterday?
Well, the issues that that were argued dealt with these areas, the area with standing. San Francisco had no standing to claim a law is unconstitutional. That's not what government officials are supposed to do. Also, they were breaking the law. County and city officials cannot refuse to enforce state law. Also, look who's in charge. States are in charge of the state. Cities are not in charge of the state. And the state preempts the field of marriage, and the city is simply an agent of that. Just like pastors, when they marry someone, they're an agent of the state. And then also, what San Francisco did by granting marriage licenses to over 4,000 homosexual couples violated the constitutional rights of over 4 million Californians who voted 4 years ago to protect marriage on the ballot. So those were the main issues, and there were some other issues, but I think it's going to be pretty open and shut. The judges are going to probably say, and the decision is due in 60 to 90 days, but the California Supreme Court will probably say, what Mayor Gavin Newsom of San Francisco did, he did in the wrong way. Okay. Unfortunately, there's some justices who will go, and you know, we could have gay marriage if you do it in the right way. Bring us a Massachusetts-style case, and we'll get to that in 2 years. Now, we as pro-family Californians say, doing the wrong thing in the wrong way, or doing the wrong thing in the right way, is still wrong. Marriage is naturally for a man and a woman. A man and a woman were designed to fit together, and you need an egg and a sperm to make a baby, and every child deserves a mother and a father. I said those things at a post-hearing news conference out near the sidewalk in front of the court building, and when I started talking about the natural design of marriage for a man and a woman, I was roundly heckled by about a half a dozen homosexual activists who were showing they did not believe in free speech nor democracy. Some of people in your audience may have seen that on court TV, and it's that heckling which is the reason that my face is on the front of the San Francisco Chronicle, Northern California's largest newspaper today.
Now, what kind of questions did the justices ask? Where do you think their questions were headed?
Well, the questions were in the good and bad category. Good questions were like, how can you justify this? You think that it's okay for local officials to disobey any law? That was that was one round of questioning. Some justices in that area said, well, what if a mayor wants to issue concealed weapons permits because he thinks that it's a Second Amendment issue, the liberals hate that. They hate the concealed weapon permits. And then another justice said, "Well, what if a local official wanted to allow houses to be built on the beach?" And the liberals hate that too, because they're really they're keeping property away from the coast. And then even a question which I found incredible, the way San Francisco's assistant attorney answered it. The Chief Justice said, well, look, what if a local mayor wanted to forbid domestic partnerships in his city, and he wanted to violate the state law requiring domestic partnership recognition? Would you be in favor of that? And the lesbian city attorney said, yes, that'd be fine. And so, Todd, it showed the ridiculousness of this. The San Francisco philosophy is you can do whatever you want, and no one can stop you. And then that's the anarchy and tyranny that their philosophy embraces.
What is the status at present, and what is likely to become of the 4,000 licenses that were issued under Gavin Newsom's direction, and the I don't know how many marriages actually were enacted on the basis of those licenses.
There's 4,037 of them. As we've said over and over, those certificates aren't worth the paper they're printed on. But the court is either going to just be silent on them, and they'll be worthless, but the court didn't say anything about them, or the court will declare them invalid, null, and void, or the court could order San Francisco to refund the money that each homosexual couple paid for those licenses and ceremonies. And I think that I think that we're in limbo on those right now, but it was good to see some newspaper headlines this morning saying that these licenses are doomed. It's just a waiting game now.
What I'm wondering about is the presumption, is the legal presumption in favor of their validity? Does someone have to go and prove they're invalid, or are they assumed to be invalid and someone has to prove that they're actually valid?
It's a great question. You know, I know that they're invalid. Marriage is only for a man and a woman. That's an easy thing. I could have had the court hearing done in 2 minutes. But it went on for 2 hours, and there are at least three judges on the seven-judge panel that were talking about, well, hey, if we invalidate these marriage licenses, does that mean those people can't be married if we hear another case like Massachusetts in the future? And I had to admire Jordan Lawrence, attorney with the Alliance Defense Fund, and his rebuttal. He said, hey, honored court, you really shouldn't talk about the inevitability of homosexual marriage. That's not the issue here. The issue is, did San Francisco have the authority? And he sort of gently took them to task, because they were way out in left field talking about making the law in the future to be homosexual marriage. It was scary.
What's the timetable we're looking at on the Supreme Court in California?
2 to 3 months. They'll issue a decision, and a lot of observers expect that it would come in July. It's interesting that also this summer, in July, a Sacramento Superior Court judge will decide the case of homosexual marriage by another name, a law passed by the Democrats here in the California legislature and signed by former Governor Gray Davis. It was stuffing all the rights of marriage into a domestic partnership package. And so we'll have two rulings on marriage in California this July.
And what is expected to become of that law?
Gay marriage by another name, that will be immediately appealed by whoever loses the case, and that would eventually make itself to the state Supreme Court. And that's why going to the courtroom yesterday was so instructive for me. I saw seven judges. I saw five of them who were quite willing to destroy parental consent for abortion. That's what they did 4 years ago. They completely overruled parental consent for abortion. I saw at least three judges who were willing to invite homosexual marriage, Massachusetts-style, through a future lawsuit. And I thought, you know what? Based on how this court votes this summer, maybe it's a 5-2 vote, 5 votes to keep to stop San Francisco and 2 votes to keep San Francisco doing what it was doing. I think those two judges should be targeted for recall.
Two final questions. You have a lawsuit that names Newsom as I guess you would call it a defendant in that. Your name is on this lawsuit. What's the status of that, given the Supreme Court decision?
Our case against the mayor, we were the first organization to file against him in February 13th. We're sort of frozen at the lower court level right now, pending the outcome of the high court's decision. So I'm not sure what's going to become of our case. I guess thanks to our attorney, Matt Staver of Liberty Counsel, who was real quick in helping us get this case filed, our case served as the spark that got the fire going, the fighting back against the rebellion of San Francisco.
And finally, Randy, is there any move afoot in California to do what so many other states are trying to do it as we speak, and that is to amend the state constitution to define marriage as a man and a woman and ban gay marriage?
Haven't seen that yet. That was considered in 1998 when Proposition 22 was considered, the drafting of it. But I think there's a need for it because we need to go to the highest legal authority possible and say, you know, marriage is for a man and a woman, no matter what the liberals want to try to manipulate out of the Equal Protection Clause.
Randy Thomason, thank you for being our guest.
Todd, it's great to be with you, and keep the faith, and remember, shine the light of truth. If you want more information, visit our website, SaveCalifornia.com. We're working to protect America from California.
The website is Save California. That's one word, SaveCalifornia.com. Randy Thomason is Executive Director of Campaign for California Families, and he joins us from Sacramento. Folks, tune in tonight from 8 to 9. The rebroadcast of today's first hour of Issues, Etc. will be there waiting for you from 8 to 9 here on AM 850 KFUO. We're answering the question, was Jesus good or was he merely nice? We're also joined by Uwe Simonetto in that hour of United Press International for a religion roundup. We'll discuss all sorts of things, what's going on in India with their elections, and also the leadership in Iraq, what's to become of that in the future. That's from 8 until 9 tonight on AM 850 KFUO. In the moments left, let me tell you about our Issues, Etc. book of the month for May, Why I Am a Lutheran, Jesus at the Center. This book is written by our regular guest here on Issues, Etc., Daniel Preuss. This is the kind of book that you wouldn't just want to get for yourself, folks. This is the kind of book that you would want to get not only for yourself, but to buy a copy for your pastor. Here's a good reason why. After he's read it, I'm sure he will want to use it as the basis for a Bible class. Good basic teaching on what it means to be a Christian, highlighting at the center of all that Christians are, confess, do, say, believe, Jesus at the center. You get one for yourself, you get one for your pastor. He can make it as the basis of a Bible class. This is the kind of thing that you could also give to every newly confirmed. You know, confirmation is coming up here in a lot of churches near the end of May, and they'll be confirming those young people in the Christian faith. This is a great gift for a confirmand you know, or encourage your pastor to see to it the congregation can buy a copy for every confirmand that they send through. It's called Why I Am a Lutheran, Jesus at the Center. You could also use it for your personal Bible study as well as those at church. Daniel Preuss is the author. The book is $14.99 plus shipping and handling. Call Concordia Publishing House any weekday during regular business hours. Ask for the Issues, Etc. book of the month for May, Why I Am a Lutheran. 1-800-325-3040. 1-800-325-3040. Or browse before you buy at our website, issuesetc.org. Just look under the What's New section. Tomorrow on the program, we'll continue our series on working mothers with Sue Ann Venker. We'll be dealing with another myth that plagues working mothers there. Oh, I could take care of my kids better if I had some more support. And we'll also talk with the author of the book, Misunderestimated, Bill Salmon of the Washington Times. Tomorrow on Issues, Etc., I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for listening.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues, Etc. Issues, Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for Issues, Etc. to continue. Our address is Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri 63117. Or you can contact us via our website at www.issuesetc.org. That's www.issuesetc.org. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of this station or the Jubilee Network. Issues, Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.